content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with a short story from the fiction section of the November 13, 2017 issue of the New Yorker magazine. Riddle by Thomas McGuane. I must have been renting a place on 8th Street in Livingston at the time, so I could meet clients in town. My home was several miles south toward Gardner. I was an architect, and I had a model of Frank Lloyd Wright's Falling Water, which I had built in school, on a library table in the front room. Most of my clients thought it was my design. The 8th Street house was on an elevated lot, facing the old sewing machine shop. I never went in there, but I recall that they sold machines with a foreign name that were said to hem, darn, baste, and stitch. Back when people did those things instead of just throwing stuff away. Eventually, the place went out of business. I had only the ground floor of the house. The upstairs was occupied by a schoolteacher who entered her apartment by way of a very unsafe-looking exterior staircase that undulated and squealed with her steps. After drinking at the Wrangler until closing time one cold November night, I wandered around to Main Street, which was empty at that hour, except for a crippled old cowboy who was making his way toward the railroad yards. There weren't many of these fellows left, the ones whom horses had broken so often in accidents far from help, their hands still as hard as lariats. They kept their worn-out Stetsons so you wouldn't confuse them with railroaders. I had stopped to watch the old man, perhaps wondering how far he'd make it in his condition, when a young boy, an urchin, appeared from an alley and called out to him, "Jack! Hey, Jack!" And the old man turned toward the voice. I don't know if I can put my finger on it after all this time, but the excitement or joy or whatever it was that these two experienced when they saw each other has never left me. That's all I can say about it. It was late at night on an empty street. Any euphoria I may have accumulated at the bar was gone. The pair met up and spoke in an animated way, though I couldn't hear them from that distance. It doesn't matter. I moved on before they did. And the boy is probably middle-aged by now, the old cowboy surely dead. Somebody later told me that he was born on the Cherokee Strip, and it worked for Benny Binion. I'm not sure if that makes any sense. We don't remember everything, but I'd love to know who's in charge of what we forget. If there's a system, it escapes me. I still remember that old cowboy and the boy's enchantment when I walked down Main, because, heading home that night, I was in kind of a trance that made me wonder, later, if I'd dreamed the rest of the evening. I had not, of course, but it had that quality, and it's hardly certain where dreams leave off. My head was clear as I drove home, out old 89 under the stars. Though my ears were still ringing from various Doobie Brothers covers by locals who'd learned rock and roll at an Air Force base in Spain. The earliest houses in the valley were set close along the road for easy access in deep snow. Their lights were off at that hour, and I could just make out their shapes as I drove. Up on the ridges, new homes glowed with yard lights and long driveways, their owners indifferent to weather. I turned on the radio, in case my post-Wrangler bar attention wavered. I lived alone in a two-story frame house built in 1905, with a still incorporated into the fireplace, in which the owner had made bottles of hooch to sell at country dances during Prohibition. Walking in the door by myself at 3 a.m. would make me long for someone to live with. Anyone. But I'd soon be asleep, and in the morning, I'd be glad to be alone again, and would remind myself that I had to keep better hours if I was going to get any work done. Just south of the cemetery, where the road starts down into the Seuss Creek bottom, was a car upside down, and two people, a man and a woman, standing beside it. The beams of my headlights carved a garish hole in the dark. I could see that the man was holding and trying to calm the agitated woman, who was pointing toward a vacancy of brush and prairie. I turned off the radio, so as to concentrate on, or try to understand, what I was seeing. I pulled up behind the overturned car without any sense that the couple was looking to me for help. On the contrary, the man was waving harshly at me to turn off my lights. When I did, I could no longer see the two of them very well, and it was unclear whether they wanted me to stay or whether there was something private about the woman's anguished wails that I should respect. The glimpse I'd had of them with my headlights on had suggested that they were uninjured. I don't know why this encouraged my bafflement or diffidence, but I just sat in my car waiting to be asked. I couldn't just sit there, but I really couldn't leave. I got out of the car, risking the parking lights, which didn't seem to offend the man as my headlights had. Now he beckoned me over, with the same kind of authoritarian gestures with which he had ordered my lights extinguished. When I reached him, he stared me straight in the face in a disquieting way. He was not big, but seemed fit, with close-cropped hair and noticeably long sideburns. He shook his head to indicate either that this entire situation was a mess, or that there was nothing to be done about the dramatic noises coming from the woman, a remarkably small person in a cotton dress that went all the way to the ground, who was still directing her cries toward the grass and underbrush. The man put his hand on my shoulder and moved me to a spot away from the noise. "She's crying for her baby," he said in an oddly confiding tone, almost as though he were selling me the idea. When I asked if the child had been thrown from the car, he said, "There is no baby. She's crazy. Just play along." His gaze was very direct. "I think you can do that." At this, the woman rushed over to us and stood just at the level of my chest, so that the peculiar arrangement of her hair, piled atop her head with a comb thrust through it, drew my exhausted scrutiny. "He don't believe me! Timmy was thrown from the back window, out in the pickers!" The man was staring at her. She touched a finger to a button on my shirt. I thought it was a curious gesture for someone in her position. Her diction, too, was in contrast to the refinement of her face and the delicacy of her clothing. The man watched her as though he'd never heard her speak before.
"Will you look for him? He don't believe me, and I got no shoes on."
The man tilted his head and nodded, and I concurred that there was no harm in going along with this. It seemed entirely possible that there was a baby. As I set off, I wondered whom I believed. I stumbled through the brush and weeds, my eyes not quite adjusted to the starry night. I thought something like a 5-minute loop would demonstrate my willingness to help, but at the same time I listened for the sound of a child. I hadn't gone far before I stepped into a badger hole and fell. By the time I got the dirt out of my eyes and my mouth, I was annoyed. I thought of the old cowboy and the boy back on Main Street and how there was something important about them that I couldn't put my finger on. I was in no hurry as I stood up to pick the thistles out of my left palm. It was thus that I observed my car drive away, two little red taillights, and this threw me into a strange reflective state, in which my dissolute night at the Wrangler and my ensuing exhaustion, the cowboy and the boy, the two crooks who had just stolen my car, my remote house, and its unconquered air of vacancy, all seemed to have equal value. That is, no value. I have gone back to this idea since, because I feel it was a clue to my eventual burden, this set of random data points by which I simply moved across some screen before being faced with a connivance that I couldn't understand, though it seemed to belong to me. The flashing light on a remote radio tower across the valley looked almost like a beacon, and I recall thinking that I could head for that as easily as go back to the road, where I no longer had a car. Later, misusing these memories to impress some girl, I would try pitching the idea that this descent into the abyss was hilarious, but I hardly laughed at the time. When I got back on the road, scuffed up, fingernails packed with clay, I looked both ways as though I might be run over on this empty highway. I knew where I was, just at the rise toward Deep Creek, Pine Creek, Barney Creek, and so on. I could smell the irrigated hay fields on the night air. I was more than 10 miles from my house on a little traveled road. The Absaroka Range made a sharp silhouette against the starlight. A car approached from the north, a pair of lights wobbling on the uneven pavement. I stood at the edge of the road, arms at my side. It pulled up beside me, and from within I heard a woman's anxious voice.
"Are you all right? You're lucky to be alive."
I made an effort to sweep the dirt from my clothes before opening the passenger door. It gave me the moment I needed to understand this interesting development. Then I got in, flinging myself back against the seat. "Yes," I breathed. "Very lucky indeed, thank you. I just need to get home."
"Shall I call someone? The someone?
She held up her phone. A pretty face, sharply focused, very dark brown eyes shone in the thing's green light. I said I didn't think it was necessary. I suppose that my own phone was traveling somewhere in the night in my car. I tried to make conversation as we drove on. "Is that Cassiopeia?" She didn't know. She was trying to watch the road. I remembered the groceries I'd had in the trunk of my car. Some apples, orange juice, lean cuisine, 2 tins of science diet cat food, a fifth of George Dickel. I knew what was going to happen. It was 3 in the morning. We didn't even get upstairs. We made love on the couch with the front door open. The cat was all over us. She started laughing and soon left. I carried my clothes upstairs, threw them on the floor, and went to bed. Karen was her name. I don't know if she got mine or not. She was an emergency room doctor and smelled like surgical tape. She was tired from work and on her way home. I'm surprised she took the time with me. I believe I enjoyed the experience, but I really couldn't stop thinking about the old cowboy and his young friend. She did tell me that her job was grim and had taught her to live it up. Maybe that explained it, if an explanation was required. I woke up hungry, but it was almost mid-morning. I had work to do. One of my skills was making models for other architects' projects. I was in far greater demand for these models than I was for my own design. In fact, they pretty well ate my career. I was making one now for a glamorous house in Bridger Canyon. It looked like a spaceship, with rooms cantilevered over a spring-fed pond. I could just picture it below the gorgeous massif of the Bridger Range. A real piece of feces. Oh well, it was a living. When I was this weary, I'd do various mindless things to get myself ready for the day, which necessarily demanded physical deftness. I was trying to drop 2 halves of a Linder's onion bagel into the slots of the toaster simultaneously, a tough hand-eye maneuver. I'd nail one, and the other would flop out onto the counter. I was further distracted by the beauty of the morning, visible above the sink, a crowd of finches in the lilacs beside the kitchen window, through which came the most ambrosial air from the spruces surrounding the yard. I didn't get a chance to eat the bagel until later in the day, when it was cold and hard. A knock on my front door turned out to be our big Sheriff Holm, bursting out of his olive uniform and smiling suspiciously at me as he offered his hand. He had a large, round Scandinavian head and blunt nose. He didn't want a bagel, so I led him into the living room, where I offered him a straight-backed chair, a white oak shaker knockoff I'd made myself, an extraordinarily uncomfortable thing that gave its occupant the feeling of enduring an inquisition while ensuring the brevity of a visit. I knew instinctively that this would be the right approach, given the startling appearance of the law. The chair made twerps out of most people, but the sheriff looked like he owned it. It may even have added to his authority. He got right to the point. "Do you know where your car is?" "I don't. It was stolen." "And you never got around to reporting it?" "I was with an emergency room doctor tending to other matters. Has it been found?" "It's in Torrington, Wyoming, full of bullet holes." This was a good time to say nothing. "They've got the guy," he added. "What about the girl?" "In the hospital. She's not going to make it. They robbed the Sinclair station in town, rolled their car, and they got some help from you." "Well, I wouldn't call it." "Really? Then why didn't you report it?" "It was late." "Pard, we answered the phone 24/7. "I should have called. Of course I should have. I should have picked up the phone and called." "I could probably make a case here. I'm not going to because I don't think it would fly, but it never needed to come to this. Maybe you should think about that. There wasn't nothing in the world wrong with that young woman. You ever see a pretty gal in a morgue? I don't recommend it." He gave me time to absorb this, but at that moment my mind was elsewhere. Who's that old cowboy walks around town in the middle of the night? It took the sheriff a moment to answer. "If he has a name, I wouldn't know it. Why do you ask?" I still had my work to do. I was able to use a shard of broken mirror for the pond. I just couldn't figure out how far back I'd have to go to put together the pieces that wound up in Torrington. This was going to take a while. Next, from the Annals of Evolution, August 15, 2011 issue of the New Yorker magazine, "Sleeping with the Enemy, What Happened Between the Neanderthals and Us," by Elizabeth Colbert. The Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig is a large, mostly glass building shaped a bit like a banana. The institute sits at the southern edge of the city, in a neighborhood that still very much bears the stamp of its East German past. If you walk down the street in one direction, you come to a block of Soviet-style apartment buildings. In the other, to a huge hall with a golden steeple, which used to be known as the Soviet Pavilion. The pavilion is now empty. In the lobby of the institute, there's a cafeteria and an exhibit on great apes. A TV in the cafeteria plays a live feed of the orangutans at the Leipzig Zoo. Svante Paabo heads the institute's Department of Evolutionary Genetics. He is tall and lanky, with a long face, a narrow chin, and bushy eyebrows, which he often raises to emphasize some sort of irony. Paabo's office is dominated by a life-size model of a Neanderthal skeleton, propped up so that its feet dangle over the floor, and by a larger-than-life-size portrait that his graduate students presented to him on his 50th birthday. Each of the students painted a piece of the portrait, the overall effect of which is a surprisingly good likeness of Paabo, but in mismatched colors that make it look as if he had skin disease. At any given moment, Paabo has at least half a dozen research efforts in progress. When I visited him in May, he had one team analyzing DNA that had been obtained from a 40 or 50,000-year-old finger bone found in Siberia, and another trying to extract DNA from a cache of equally ancient bones from China. A third team was slicing open the brains of mice that had been genetically engineered to produce a human protein. In Paabo's mind, at least, these research efforts all hang together. They are attempts to solve a single problem in evolutionary genetics, which might, rather dizzyingly, be posed as, what made us the sort of animal that could create a transgenic mouse? The question of what defines the human has, of course, been kicking around since Socrates, and probably a lot longer. If it has yet to be satisfactorily resolved, then this, Paabo suspects, is because it has never been properly framed. The challenge is to address the questions that are answerable, he told me. Paabo's most ambitious project to date, which he has assembled an international consortium to assist him with, is an attempt to sequence the entire genome of the Neanderthal. The project is about halfway complete and has already yielded some unsettling results, including the news, announced by Paabo last year, that modern humans, before doing in the Neanderthals, must have interbred with them. Once the Neanderthal genome is complete, scientists will be able to lay it gene by gene, indeed base by base, against the human and see where they diverge. At that point, Paabo believes, an answer to the age-old question will finally be at hand. Neanderthals were very closely related to modern humans, so closely that we shared our prehistoric beds with them, and yet clearly they were not humans. Somewhere among the genetic disparities must lie the mutation, or more probably mutations, that define us. Paabo already has a team scanning the two genomes, drawing up lists of likely candidates. I want to know what changed in fully modern humans compared with Neanderthals that made a difference, he said. What made it possible for us to build up these enormous societies and spread around the globe and develop the technology that I think no one can doubt is unique to humans? There has to be a genetic basis for that, and it is hiding somewhere in these lists. Paabo, who is now 56, grew up in Stockholm. His mother, a chemist, was an Estonian refugee. For a time, she worked in the laboratory of a biochemist named Sune Bergström, who later won a Nobel Prize. Paabo was the product of a lab affair between the two, and although he knew who his father was, he wasn't supposed to discuss it. Bergström had a wife and another son. Paabo's mother, meanwhile, never married. Every Saturday, Bergström would visit Paabo and take him for a walk in the woods or somewhere else where he didn't think he'd be recognized. Officially at home, he worked on Saturday, Paabo told me. It was really crazy. His wife knew, but they never talked about it. She never tried to call him at work on Saturday. As a child, Paabo wasn't particularly bothered by the whole arrangement. Later, he occasionally threatened to knock on Bergström's door. I would say you have to tell your son, your other son, because he will find out sometime, he recalled. Bergström would promise to do this, but never followed through. As a result, Bergström's other son did not learn that Paabo existed until shortly before Bergström's death in 2004. From an early age, Paabo was interested in old things. He discovered that around fallen trees it was sometimes possible to find bits of pottery made by prehistoric Swedes, and he filled his room with pot shards. When he was a teenager, his mother took him to visit the pyramids, and he was entranced. He enrolled at Uppsala University, planning to become an Egyptologist. I really wanted to discover mummies like Indiana Jones, he said. Mostly, though, the coursework turned out to be to involve parsing hieroglyphics, and instead of finding it swashbuckling, Paabo thought it was boring. Inspired by his father, he switched first to medicine and then to cell biology. In the early 1980s, Paabo was doing doctoral research on viruses when he once again began fantasizing about mummies. At least, as far as he could tell, no one had ever tried to obtain DNA from an ancient corpse. It occurred to him that if this was possible, then a whole new way of studying history would open up. Suspecting that his dissertation advisor would find the idea silly or worse, Paabo conducted his mummy research in secret at night. With the help of one of his former Egyptology professors, he managed to obtain some samples from the Egyptian Museum in what was then East Berlin. In 1984, he published his results in an obscure East German journal. He had, he wrote, been able to detect DNA in the cells of a mummified child who'd been dead for more than 2,000 years. Among the questions that Paabo thought mummy DNA could answer were what caused Pharaonic dynasties to change, and who Tutankhamun's mom was. While Paabo was preparing a version of his mummy paper for publication in English, a group of scientists from the University of California at Berkeley announced that they had succeeded in sequencing a snippet of DNA from a zebra-like animal known as a quagga, which had been hunted to extinction in the 1880s. The DNA came from a 140-year-old quagga hide preserved at the National History Museum in Mainz. The leader of the team, Alan Wilson, was an eminent biochemist who had, among other things, come up with a way to study evolution using the concept of a molecular clock. Paabo sent Wilson the galleys of his mummy paper. Impressed, Wilson replied, asking if there was any space in Paabo's lab. He might like to spend a sabbatical there. Paabo had to write back that he could not offer Wilson space in his lab because, regrettably, he didn't have a lab, or even at that point, a Ph.D. Paabo's mummy paper became the cover article in Nature. It was also written up in the Times, which called his achievement, quote, the most dramatic of a series of recent accomplishments using molecular biology, end quote. Paabo's colleagues in Sweden, though, remained skeptical. They urged him to forget about shriveled corpses and stick to viruses.
Everybody told me that it was really stupid to leave that important area for something which looked like a hobby of some sort, he said.
Ignoring them, Paabo moved to Berkeley to work for Wilson. He just kind of glided in, Mary Claire King, who had also been a student of Wilson's and who is now a professor of genome sciences at the University of Washington, recalled. According to King, Paabo and Wilson, who died in 1991, turned out to share much more than an interest in ancient DNA. Each of them thought of very big ideas, she told me, and each of them was very good at translating those ideas into testable hypotheses. And then each of them was very good at developing the technology that's necessary to test the hypotheses. And to have all three of those capacities is really remarkable. Also, although they were both very data-driven, neither was afraid to say outrageous things about their data, and neither was afraid to be wrong. DNA is often compared to a text, a comparison that's apt as long as the definition of text encompasses writing that doesn't make sense. DNA consists of molecules known as nucleotides knit together in the shape of a ladder, the famous double helix. Each nucleotide contains one of the four bases, adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine, which are designated by the letters A, T, G, and C, so that a stretch of the human genome might be represented as ACCT, CCT, CTAAT, GTCA. This is an actual sequence from chromosome number 10. The comparable sequence in an elephant is ACCT, CCCC, TAATG, TCA. The human genome is 3 billion bases, or really base pairs. As far as can be determined, most of it is junk. With the exception of red blood cells, every cell in an organism contains a complete copy of its DNA. It also contains many copies, hundreds to thousands, of an abridged form of DNA known as mitochondrial DNA, or mtDNA. But as soon as the organism dies, the long chains of nucleotides begin to break down. Much of the damage is done in the first few hours by enzymes inside the creature's own body. After a while, all that remains is snippets, and after a longer while, how long seems to depend on the conditions of decomposition, these snippets, too, disintegrate.
Maybe in the permafrost you could go back 500,000 years, Papa told me, but it's certainly on this side of a million.
500,000 years ago, the dinosaurs had been dead for more than 64 million years. So the whole Jurassic Park fantasy is, sadly, just that. On the other hand, 500,000 years ago, modern humans did not yet exist. When Paabo arrived in California, he was still interested in finding a way to use genetics to study human history. He discovered, however, a big problem with trying to locate fragments of ancient Egyptian DNA. They look an awful lot like, indeed identical to, fragments of contemporary human DNA. Thus, a single microscopic particle of his own skin or of someone else's, even some long-dead museum curators, could nullify months of work.
It became clear that human contamination was a huge problem, he explained.
Eventually, Paabo concluded that the sequences he had obtained for his original mummy paper had probably been corrupted in this way. As a sort of warm-up exercise, he began working on extinct animals. He analyzed scraps of mtDNA from giant ground sloths, which disappeared about 12,000 years ago, and from mammoths, which vanished around the same time, and from Tasmanian tigers, which were hunted to extinction by the 1930s. He extracted mtDNA from moas, the giant flightless birds that populated New Zealand before the arrival of the Maori, and found that moas were more closely related to birds from Australia than to kiwis, the flightless birds that inhabit New Zealand today.
That was a blow to New Zealand's self-esteem, he recalled.
He also probed plenty of remains that yielded no usable DNA, including bones from the La Brea tar pits and fossilized insects preserved in amber. In the process of this work, Paabo more or less invented the field of paleogenetics. Frankly, it was a problem that I wouldn't have tackled myself because I thought it was too difficult. Maynard Olson, an emeritus professor at the University of Washington and one of the founders of the Human Genome Project, told me. Paabo brought very high standards to this area and took the field of ancient DNA study from its Jurassic Park origins to a real science, which, that is a major accomplishment.
Well, there's nothing unique about most of science, Ed Green, a professor of biomolecular engineering at the University of California at Santa Cruz, who works on the Neanderthal Genome Project, said. If you don't do it, somebody else is going to do it a few months later. Savanti is one of the rare people in science for whom that is not true. There wouldn't even be a field of ancient DNA, as we know it, without him.
Well, it's a nice rarity in science when people take not only unique but also productive paths, Craig Venter, who led a rival effort to the Human Genome Project, told me. And Svante has clearly done both. I have immense respect for him and what he's done. While Paabo was living in California, he sometimes went to Germany to visit a woman who was attending graduate school at the University of Munich.
I had many relationships with men, but I also had girlfriends now and again, he told me.
The relationship ended shortly afterward. The University of Munich offered Paabo an assistant professorship. With no pressing reason to move to Germany, he demurred. The offer was increased to a full professorship.
So then I said, well, Germany isn't that bad after all. I'll go there for a few years.
Paabo was still in Munich several years later when he got a call from the Rhenish State Museum in Bonn. The museum houses the bones of the first Neanderthal to be identified as such, which was discovered in the summer of 1856. What did Paabo think the odds were that he could extract usable DNA? He had no way of determining what kind of shape the bones were in until he dissolved them.
I didn't know what to tell them, so I said, there's a 5% chance that it worked, he recalled.
A few months later, he received a small chunk of the Neanderthal's right humerus. The first Neanderthal was found in a limestone cave about 45 miles north of Bonn, in an area known as the Neander Valley, or in German, Das Neandertal. Although the cave is gone, the limestone was long ago quarried into building blocks. The area is now a sort of Neanderthal theme park, with its own museum, hiking trails, and a garden planted with the kinds of shrubs that would have been encountered during an ice age. In the museum, Neanderthals are portrayed as kindly, if not particularly telegenic, humans. By the entrance to the building, there's a model of an elderly Neanderthal leaning on a stick. He is smiling benignantly and resembles an unkempt Yogi Berra. Next to him is one of the museum's most popular attractions, a booth called the Morphing Station. For €3, visitors to the station can get a normal profile shot of themselves and, facing that, a second shot that had been doctored. In the second, the chin recedes, the forehead slopes, and the back of the head bulges out. Kids love to see themselves, or better yet, their siblings, morphed into Neanderthals. They find it screamingly funny. When the first Neanderthal bones showed up in the Neander Valley, they were treated as rubbish, and almost certainly damaged in the process. The fragments, a skull cap, four arm bones, two thigh bones, and a part of a pelvis, were later salvaged by a local businessman who, thinking they belonged to a cave bear, passed them on to a fossil collector. The fossil collector realized that he was dealing with something much stranger than a bear. He declared the remains to be traces of a, quote, primitive member of our race, end quote. As it happened, this was right around the time that Darwin published On the Origin of Species, and the fragments soon got caught up in the debate over the origin of humans. Opponents of evolution insisted that they belonged to an ordinary person. One theory held that it was a Cossack who had wandered into the region in the tumult following the Napoleonic Wars. The reason the bones looked odd, Neanderthal femurs are distinctly bowed, was that the Cossack had spent too long on his horse. Another attributed the remains to a man with rickets. The man had been in so much pain from his disease that he'd kept his forehead perpetually tensed, hence the protruding brow ridge. What a man with rickets and in constant pain was doing climbing into a cave was never really explained. Over the next decades, bones resembling those from the Neander Valley, thicker than those of modern humans, with strangely shaped skulls, were discovered at several more sites, including two in Belgium and one in France. Meanwhile, a skull that had been unearthed years earlier in Gibraltar was shown to look much like the one from Germany. Clearly, all these remains could not be explained by stories of disoriented Cossacks or rachitic spelunkers. But evolutionists, too, were perplexed by them. Neanderthals had very large skulls, larger on average than people today. This made it hard to fit them into an account of evolution that started with small-brained apes and led through progressively bigger brains up to humans. In The Descent of Man, which appeared in 1871, Darwin mentioned Neanderthals only in passing. It must be admitted that some skulls of very high antiquity, such as the famous one of Neanderthal, are well developed and capacious, he noted. In 1908, a nearly complete Neanderthal skeleton was discovered in a cave in southern France. The skeleton was sent to a paleontologist named Marcelin Boule at Paris's National Museum of Natural History. In a series of monographs, Boule invented what might be called the cartoon version of Neanderthals, bent-kneed, hunched over, and brutish. Neanderthal bones, Boule wrote, displayed a distinctly simian arrangement, while the shape of their skulls indicated the predominance of functions of a purely vegetative or bestial kind. Boole's conclusions were studied and then echoed by many of his contemporaries. The British anthropologist Sir Grafton Elliott Smith, for instance, described Neanderthals as walking with a half-stooping slouch upon legs of a peculiarly ungraceful form. Smith also claimed that Neanderthals' unattractiveness was further emphasized by a shaggy covering of hair over most of the body, although there was and still is no clear evidence that they were hairy. In the 1950s, a pair of anatomists, William Strauss and Alexander Cave, decided to re-examine the skeleton. What Boole had taken for the Neanderthal's natural posture, Strauss and Cave determined was probably a function of arthritis. Neanderthals did not walk with a slouch or with bent knees. Indeed, given a shave and a new suit, the pair wrote, a Neanderthal probably would attract no more attention on a New York City subway than some of its other denizens. More recent scholarship has tended to support the idea that Neanderthals, if not quite up to negotiating the IRT, certainly walked upright with a gait we would recognize more or less as our own. The version of Neanderthals offered by the Neanderthal Museum, another cartoon, is imbued with cheerful dignity. Neanderthals are presented as living in teepees, wearing what look like leather yoga pants, and gazing contemplatively over the frozen landscape. Neanderthal man was not some prehistoric Rambo, one of the display tags admonishes. He was an intelligent individual. About 2 years into the project to sequence the entire Neanderthal genome, a new puzzle arose. Paavo had assembled an international team to help analyze the data the sequencing machines were generating. Sifting through the data, one of the members of this team, David Reich, noticed something odd. The Neanderthal sequences, as expected, were very similar to human sequences. But they were more similar to some humans than to others. Specifically, Europeans and Asians shared more DNA with Neanderthals than did Africans. We tried to make this result go away, Reich told me. We thought, this must be wrong. For the past 25 years or so, the study of human evolution has been dominated by the theory known in the popular press as out of Africa, and in academic circles as the recent single origin or replacement hypothesis. This theory holds that all modern humans are descended from a small population that lived in Africa roughly 200,000 years ago. Not long before he died, Paavo's advisor, Alan Wilson, developed one of the key lines of evidence for the theory based on a comparison of mitochondrial DNA from contemporary humans. Around 120,000 years ago, a subset of the population migrated into the Middle East, and by 50,000 years ago, a further subset pushed into Eurasia. As they moved north and east, modern humans encountered Neanderthals and other so-called archaic humans who already inhabited those regions. The modern humans replaced the archaic humans, which is a nice way of saying they drove them into extinction. This model of migration and replacement implies that the relationship between Neanderthals and humans should be the same for all people alive today, regardless of where they came from. In a paper published in Science in May 2010, they introduced what Paavo has come to refer to as the leaky replacement hypothesis. The paper was later voted the journal's outstanding article of the year, and the team received a $25,000 prize. Before modern humans replaced the Neanderthals, they had sex with them. The liaisons produced children who helped to people Europe, Asia, and the New World. The leaky replacement hypothesis, assuming for the moment that it is correct, provides further evidence of the closeness of Neanderthals to modern humans. Not only did the two interbreed, the resulting hybrid offspring were functional enough to be integrated into human society. Some of these hybrids survived to have kids of their own, who, in turn, had kids, and so on to the present day. Even now, at least 30,000 years after the fact, the signal is discernible. All non-Africans, from New Guineans to the French to the Han Chinese, carry somewhere between 1 and 4% Neanderthal DNA. One of Paavo's favorite words in English is cool. When he finally came around to the idea that Neanderthals bequeathed some of their genes to modern humans, he told me, "I thought it was very cool. It means they are not totally extinct, that they live on a little bit in us." One way to answer the question, what makes us human, is to ask what makes us different from apes, or to be more precise, from non-human apes, since, of course, humans are apes. As just about every human by now knows, non-human apes are extremely clever. They're capable of making inferences, of solving complex puzzles, and of understanding what others are and are not likely to know. When researchers from Leipzig performed a battery of tests on chimpanzees, orangutans, and 2.5-year-old children, They found that the chimps, the orangutans, and the kids performed comparably on a wide range of tests that involved understanding of the physical world. For example, if an experimenter placed a reward inside one of three cups and then moved the cups around, the apes found the goody just as often as the kids. Indeed, in the case of chimps, more often. The apes seemed to grasp quantity as well as the kids did. They consistently chose the dish containing more treats, even when the choice involved using what might loosely be called math, and also seemed to have just as good a grasp of causality. The apes, for instance, understood that a cup that rattled when shaken was more likely to contain food than one that did not. And they were equally skillful at manipulating simple tools. Where the kids routinely outscored the apes was in tests that involved reading social cues. When the children were given a hint about where to find a reward, someone pointing to or looking at the right container, they took it. The apes either didn't understand that they were being offered help or couldn't follow the clue. Similarly, when the children were shown how to obtain a reward by, say, ripping open a box, they had no trouble grasping the point and imitating the behavior. The apes, once again, were flummoxed. Admittedly, the kids had a big advantage in the social realm, since the experimenters belonged to their own species. But in general, apes seem to lack the impulse toward collective problem-solving that's so central to human society. Chimps do a lot of incredibly smart things, Michael Tomasello, who heads up the Institute's Department of Developmental and Comparative Psychology, told me. But the main difference we're seeing is putting our heads together. If you were at the zoo today, you would never have seen two chimps carry something heavy together. They don't have this kind of collaborative projects. By now, scores of Neanderthal sites have been evacuated. They give lots of hints about what Neanderthals were like, at least for those inclined to speculate. Neanderthals were extremely tough. This is attested to by the thickness of their bones, and probably capable of beating modern humans to a pulp. They were adept at making stone tools, though they seem to have spent tens of thousands of years making the same tools over and over, with only marginal variation. At least on some occasions, they buried their dead. Also on some occasions, they appear to have killed and eaten each other, where on their incisors suggests that they spent a lot of time grasping animal skins with their teeth, which in turn suggests that they processed hides into some sort of leather. Neanderthal skeletons very often show evidence of disease or disfigurement. The original Neanderthal from Metmon, for example, seems to have suffered and recovered from two serious injuries, one to his head and the other to his left arm. The Neanderthal, whose nearly complete skeleton was found in southern France, endured, in addition to arthritis, a broken rib, and kneecap. Both individuals survived into their 50s, which indicates that Neanderthals had the capacity for collective action or, if you prefer, empathy. They must, at least sometimes, have cared for their wounded. From the archaeological record, it's inferred that Neanderthals evolved in Europe or Western Asia and spread out from there, stopping when they reached water or some other significant obstacle. During the Ice Ages, sea levels were a lot lower than they are now, so there was no English Channel to cross. This is one of the most basic ways modern humans differ from Neanderthals, and, in Paabo's view, also one of the most intriguing. By about 45,000 years ago, modern humans had already reached Australia, a journey that, even mid-Ice Age, meant crossing open water. Archaic humans, like Homo erectus, spread like many other mammals in the old world, Paabo told me. They never came to Madagascar, never to Australia. Neither did Neanderthals. It's only fully modern humans who start this thing of venturing out on the ocean where you don't see land. Part of that is technology, of course. You have to have ships to do it, but there is also, I like to think or say, some madness there, you know? How many people must have sailed out and vanished on the Pacific before you found Easter Island? I mean, it's ridiculous. And why do you do that? Is it for the glory? For immortality? For curiosity? And now we go to Mars? We never stop. If the defining characteristics of modern humans is this sort of Faustian restlessness, then by Paabo's account, there must be some sort of Faustian gene. Several times he told me that he thought it should be possible to identify the basis for this madness by comparing Neanderthal and human DNA.
If we one day will know that some freak mutation made the human insanity and expiration thing possible, it will be amazing to think that it was this little inversion on this chromosome that made all this happen and changed the whole ecosystem of the planet and made us dominate everything, he said at one point. At another, he said, we are crazy in some way. What drives it? That I would really like to understand. That would be really, really cool to know.
According to the most recent estimates, Neanderthals and modern humans share a common ancestor who lived about 400,000 years ago. It is unclear who that ancestor was, though one possibility is the somewhat shadowy hominid known after a jawbone found near Heidelberg as Homo heidelbergensis. The common ancestor of chimps and humans, by contrast, lived some 5 million to 7 million years ago. This means that Neanderthals and humans had less than one-tenth the time to accumulate genetic differences. With old bones, you never really know what you're going to get. A few years ago, Paabo managed to get hold of a bit of tooth from one of the so-called hobbit skeletons found on the island of Flores in Indonesia. The hobbits, who were discovered in 2004, are generally believed to have been diminutive archaic humans. The tooth, which was about 17,000 years old, yielded no DNA. Then, about a year and a half ago, Paabo obtained a fragment of finger bone that had been unearthed in a cave in southern Siberia, along with a weird, vaguely human-looking molar. In contrast to the hobbit tooth, the finger fragment yielded astonishingly large amounts of DNA. The DNA showed that the digit could not have belonged to a Neanderthal or to a modern human. Instead, its owner must have been part of some entirely different and previously unsuspected type of hominid. In a paper published in December 2010 in Nature, Paabo and his team dubbed this group the Denisovans after the Denisova cave where the bone had been found. Giving accepted prehistoric history, the finger, ran the headline on the story in the Sydney Morning Herald. Amazingly, or perhaps by now predictably, modern humans must have interbred with the Denisovans, too, because contemporary New Guineans carry up to 6% Denisovan DNA. It has been understood for a long time that modern humans and Neanderthals were contemporaries. The discovery of the hobbits and now the Denisovans shows that humans shared the planet with at least two additional creatures like ourselves. And it seems likely that as DNA from more ancient remains is analyzed, still other human relatives will be found. As Chris Stringer, a prominent British paleoanthropologist, told me, I'm sure we've got more surprises to come.
If these other forms of humans had survived 2,000 generations more, which is not so much, then how would that have influenced our view of the living world? Paabo said. We now make this very clear distinction between humans and animals, but it might not be as clear. That is sort of an interesting thing to philosophize about.
It's also interesting to think about why we're the ones who survived. Over the decades, many theories have been offered to explain what caused the demise of the Neanderthals, ranging from climate change to simple bad luck. In recent years, though, it's become increasingly clear that, as Paabo put it to me, their bad luck was us. Again and again, the archaeological evidence in Europe indicates once modern humans showed up in a region where Neanderthals were living, the Neanderthals in that region vanished. Perhaps the Neanderthals were actively pursued, or perhaps they were just outcompeted. The Neanderthals' bad luck is presumably the same misfortune that the hobbits and the Denisovans encountered, and similar to the tragedy suffered by the giant marsupials that once browsed Australia, and the varied megafauna that used to inhabit North America, and the moas that lived in New Zealand. And it is precisely the same bad luck that has brought so many species, including every one of the great apes, to the edge of oblivion today.
To me, the mystery is not the extinction of the Neanderthals. Jean-Jacques Houblon, the director of the Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology's Department of Human Evolution, told me. To me, the mystery is what makes modern humans such a successful group, that they have been just replacing not just the Neanderthals, but everything. We don't have much evidence that the Neanderthals or other archaic humans ever led to an extinction of a species of mammal or anything else. For modern humans, there are hundreds of examples, and we do it very well. Among the hundreds of thousands of Neanderthal artifacts that have been unearthed, almost none represent unambiguous attempts at art or adornment, and those of which have been interpreted this way, for instance, ivory pendants discovered in a cave in central France, are the subject of endless, often abstruse, disputes. Many archaeologists believe that the pendants were created by Neanderthals who had come into contact with modern humans and were trying to imitate them. But relying on the most recent dating techniques, some argue that the pendants were, in fact, created by modern humans. This paucity has led some to propose that Neanderthals were not capable of art or, what amounts to much the same thing, not interested in it. They simply did not possess what, genomically speaking, might be called the aesthetic mutation. On one of my last days in Dordogne, I decided to visit a nearby human site known for its extraordinary images. The site is a very long, narrow cave that zigzags through a limestone cliff. Hundreds of feet in, the walls of the cave are covered with engravings, a mammoth curling its trunk, a wild horse lifting its head, a reindeer leaning forward, apparently to drink. In very recent times, the floor of the cave has been dug out so that a person can walk in it, and the tunnel is dimly lit by electric lights. But when the etchings were originally created, some 12 or 13,000 years ago, the only way to gain access to the site would have been to crawl, and the only way to see in the absolute dark would have been to carry fire. As I crept along through the gloom in the cave, it occurred to me that I had really no clue what would drive someone to wriggle through a pitch-black tunnel to cover the walls with images that only another similarly driven soul would see. Yet it also struck me that so much of what is distinctively human was here on display. Creativity, daring, madness. And then there were the animals pictured on the walls. These were the beasts that Paleolithic Europeans had hunted, and then one by one, as with the Neanderthals, obliterated. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and/or print impaired. The readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you so much for listening to North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.